I started reading The Pitch as a teenager in the 1990s. At first, my friends and I would sit laughing over the news of the weird and missed connections. But over time, I started reading the actual stories in the paper. They revealed a side of the city I didn't know, whether it was the music from local bands or simmering controversies surrounding politics or business. Like other print publications, The Pitch has spent the past few years getting leaner and leaner. And now word is out that The Pitch will go from being a weekly paper to a monthly. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, I'll be talking with editor Scott Wilson about that shift and what it means for Kansas City. Then we'll open up a discussion about last week's devastating shooting in an Olathe bar. For now, Scott Wilson, good morning.
Good morning.
Why is The Pitch going monthly?
Well, it's a business decision, and I'm not on the business side of the office, but our parent company, which is based in Nashville, has a pretty firm belief that newsprint advertising, such as what we've subsisted on for the entirety of our existence, is only going to keep getting less valuable. And one way to try to stave off further decline is to go to a glossy, a coated stock. So a better quality of paper, a more vibrant color.
So magazine-y.
Magazine-y, yeah. And from a storytelling perspective, I can get on board with that because having seen the prototype, it's a good-looking print job. It separates us from other products in the marketplace. And, you know, selfishly as an editor, I want the stuff we put out to look as good as it reads. And this is a way for us to do that. And, you know, one hopes not keep getting leaner, but at least kind of stay in place and begin to grow again however we can.
When you say that from a storytelling perspective you can get on board, can you explain what you mean by that?
I mean that one thing that you want to see in a publication and one thing you're used to seeing in a magazine is a presentation that tricks the eye into reading what's on it. You know, I started reading The Pitch when I was a teenager, but that was in the 1980s, and it took me a while also to start actually reading the stuff that was more newsy or more political than just album reviews, which is, you know, a rite of passage. Everybody starts somewhere, and that's where I started as both a reader and then later a writer. And when a publication is born in a record store basement, that makes sense. But we've moved on since then, and media has moved on. So one thing we always want is, if we're reviewing a restaurant, we want a great food photo. And that's really hard to reproduce on newsprint. And if we're telling a more complex story in which the presentation of data or charts or compelling photography or even a witty illustration, every advantage we can have in conveying that story and keeping attention on the page long enough for somebody to absorb it is beneficial. So the better the paper, the better the color, the better we are.
The Pitch, to me, has a little bit of a watchdog kind of tone and role in a lot of ways, just in its presence doing investigative work and being fairly, I don't know, often critical of business dealings or political moves. How do you think you'll maintain an active presence on that front with this new schedule? I mean, if you're following a story, a lot can unfold in the time between one issue and the next. Is that something that worries you?
It's always a challenge anyway, because we've had to evolve, particularly in the past 10 years, 15 years since I've been there full time. The web has changed how we report, and we've had a blog steadily. We've had a daily presence, a social media presence, and those things won't change, and we do hope they continue to improve.
So it's not just issue to issue.
No. What we're able to do with a monthly will be to present long-form journalism, which is a very buzzy expression these days, but that's what it amounts to. It's stuff that's longer. And, you know, we've seen something of a bell. When I started there full-time, a cover story could be 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 words. And we have not had the space to do that in a while, and now we will. We'll be able to do things that aren't necessarily scary long like that, because we know people don't always make it to the end of that story. But we'll be able to break some news, and we will be able to tell stories better and longer than we have in a little while. And that's a change for us, but it will not be a change in tone or voice or mission. It's just a matter of how often we come out, and then, you know, interstitially in the meantime, from issue to issue, how much we can get done online.
How would you describe the role of the pitch in Kansas City's media landscape?
Well, alternative media, which is the phrase we used to sort of proudly bear up under, alt has become kind of a nasty expression of late. And really, for our purposes, it has its roots in being an alternative to what we now call mainstream media. So in any given market, you've always had a daily paper, and you need that to be vibrant and successful in order to punch up at it and find the gaps in its coverage and find the oddities in its tone and the things you disagree with. And that's the longstanding mission of alternative journalism. And the way media climates have changed, it's not enough really to be an alternative. You also have to, in some ways, complement what it or the TV stations or what you guys do here. It's a matter of, again, finding, if not a gap in coverage, one in tone, finding a different way to address certain issues, certain topics.
What is that different way? How would you characterize it?
In very crude form, I would say that it's about people. So you zero in on characters and you work from their perspective outward. You find people who are doing interesting, unique, difficult things. Sometimes you find people who've done the wrong thing, and you talk to those people, and you are the lens through which they sort of project, you know, their story or their version of how news unfolds. And that's different, very different from a traditional inverted pyramid news story, which has always been anathema to what we do. We go longer, and that's not just a matter of length, but of philosophy.
When you talk about finding gaps in mainstream media coverage, what do you think are the gaps in Kansas City's media coverage that the pitch is out there trying to fill?
Well, historically, it's been different things at different times. I would say that right now, we get to be as angry or as difficult or whatever our mood is at that given time. You know, it's a very odd media climate that trickles down. We try to be, we have always been very, very local. And at the same time, everything that happens nationally and internationally ultimately finds a different way of expressing itself in a local market. And so we are attuned to that. And when we talk about a gap in coverage, I'll just say as a very broad, for instance, the Kansas City Star's editorial board turned over last year. And while we are not editorial in as much as we don't write op-eds, we're not out there saying, you know, vote this way, vote that way, I believe that there's a push in the daily in this market to recapture what it believes to have been lost to a liberal perception, the perception that editorial board leaned left or too far left. And I think media is progressive. I think certainly our paper is progressive, and that doesn't mean liberal. It doesn't mean left. It just means progress. It means, you know, we're interested in getting better. And earlier you used the word critical. We have been critical of certain civic structures, certain business practices. That's not a matter of criticizing for its own sake, but rather of aiming to improve, aiming to spark improvement. And that's sort of our mission.
You know, as print publications get smaller and less frequent, as newsrooms shrink and move to smaller office spaces, I think a question in the back of a lot of people's minds, one we obviously hope turns out to be a silly question, is whether this is just the beginning of the end. And I really hate to ask that question out loud, and especially of you, because more than anyone I can imagine, you have a lot at stake when it comes to the future of print news. But is that a question that keeps you up at night?
No, it mostly wakes me up in the middle of the night. I would say that it's, you know,
a minor distinction.
I would say we're always sort of at the middle of the end because things change. We're not at the end of anything as a publication right now. We're at the beginning of a new kind of presentation. But I think anytime we talk media, whether it's you and me just hanging out or anybody calling me and asking me these sorts of questions, and people do, it's a matter of not sheer binary survival. Yes, we exist. No, we don't exist. It's a question of how do we ourselves stay relevant? And I'll go back to saying that's as long as we have smart people who are critical of the way business is done here, the way politics is done here, then I think we have a future. I think No, it's not the beginning of the end, and it's not the middle of the end, and it's not the end of the end. You're right, we've never been leaner, and we've gotten leaner over a period of time. And it's very difficult in media because once you demonstrate that you can continue to exist with less, people tend not to give you more back, you know. Financiers or boards or what have you, they tend not to re-up. They see that you're doing what you're doing. If I have a pie-in-the-sky goal here, it's to prove that maxim wrong and to get good enough at this in a difficult climate that we get reinvested in and we improve.
You have worked at The Pitch for a long time. When we met, I was an editor there, and you wrote music reviews. It felt, and maybe this is just because I was in my early 20s and everything feels this way in your early 20s, but it felt kind of like the glory days. You know what I mean? Like, we had office beer on Friday afternoons, and I had a corner cubicle overlooking Main Street downtown. There was this whole staff of people, young people, going to shows, but also digging up dirt at City Hall. I can't think of a better embodiment of the phrase work hard, play hard. Tell me about that time from your perspective, knowing what you do now, now that you've risen to the role of editor-in-chief, now that media has changed the way it has.
Well, I would say that media always needs beer. I would say that if we had office liquor now, that would be perhaps an improvement. Those were glory days, and I think everybody, you know, whatever your job is, you deserve to have something you can look back on like that and feel really positive about. And I made great friends, and I think a lot of us are still friends. And I've gotten to, as times have changed, hire people who I think are, you know, who would have fitted in that environment pretty easily. And we've been very lucky in as much as we've always attracted really talented, very smart people. And though there are fewer of them than there used to be, I would say that it's a different kind of glory we're in right now, but I wouldn't do anything else by choice.
Do you think, I mean, what do you think has changed for readers since then?
I think readers are an odd mix of more savvy now than they used to be because, on the other hand, they're so inundated with so much stuff that it's more incumbent on them to make choices about not only what they consume, how much they consume, but what they think of it after the fact. And it's, you know, it's vital that media, people like us, trust the consumer to understand what we're saying and that we not talk down to them, that we not patronize, and that we not, worry about that too much on the other hand. We just do what we do and we make sure that it's up to our own standards.
Scott Wilson, good luck to you in The Pitch as you go from being, well, I know alt doesn't please you, but a weekly to a monthly.
Thank you.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll discuss how the anti-foreign rhetoric that accompanied last week's fatal shooting in Olathe, leaving one young Indian man dead and another injured, is affecting members of our community, particularly those from South Asia. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888.
చెడుకు ఎదురు పోరాడే మంచినెప్పుడు కాపాడే.
In a room lit only by candles, hundreds of community members joined together last night for a peaceful vigil celebrating the lives of victims of last week's shooting in Olathe. The room was packed with crowds spilling out into the lobby and onto sidewalks. Sunny Tamala was there holding a sign.
My sign says, "No place for hate in America."
He's 20 years old and currently enrolled at the University of Michigan. But he grew up in Overland Park with parents who came here from India. He came home for spring break just days after the shooting.
It was just weird coming back because home's always just been this extremely happy place to me, especially coming from college. And it just suddenly this air of silence, of this fear. My parents have always been kind of worried for me, you know, my skin color. What if somehow this ends up causing some tragedy for me? And that fear definitely kind of spiked when I came back. And the victims, they're just these clean-cut looking guys, just having a beer after work. So normal. And then that could have been me. And that terrifies them.
They're not the only ones. In fact, the father of a young man who was injured in Wednesday's shooting after a gunman shouted racial slurs has issued a plea that's been heard both here and abroad. He urged other parents in India not to send their children to the United States for school. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, what's going through the minds of young people already living here and studying here after this devastating incident? Navia Sani is from the same town in India as the worried father we just heard about, the father of Alok Madhusani, who came here to attend UMKC and went on to work a high-tech job at Garmin. Navia is currently getting her master's in electrical engineering from UMKC. Hi, Navia.
Hello.
What have you heard from your friends and family back home since last Wednesday?
From friends, we all were worried, like, why is it happening? Because what we thought about Kansas or Missouri was not this. And from my parents and other family members, what we were hearing was, okay, it's no more safe. Come back soon. You're not allowed to roam around. Please don't roam around anymore. Let it be during the school hours too. All they asked us was just go to school, come back. Don't talk to anybody. Don't get into any arguments. Even if somebody is wantedly poking you and saying something against your race, this color of your skin, don't say, just ignore and leave the place is what they say.
Are those things that happen to you? Do people talk to you about your race and the color of your skin?
Yes, but in a positive note. I haven't never faced like racism on this note, what happened on Wednesday, or where people were doing some negative things or were pointing to me saying, this is you and your race doing it. We were always, I can't say like the most reputed people, but we were always being said, wow, look at Priyanka Chopra. Look at anybody in the industry of IT who are doing like Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google. So they deal to us like the techie guys. Okay, Indians are like this. Brown skin people are the techie cool people. But this was the first time when we were being treated illegal. I don't know what is happening around the country and will it be the same. But I can say if this continues, this place is not going to be safe for especially brown-skinned people.
So that's how I want to know more about how you are feeling. I mean, we've heard about what you're hearing from friends and family and what your experience up until now has been. How have you been feeling in the last almost week?
I'm not liking. I feel as though my wings are being cut down. When I came to U.S., I had the dreams like U.S. is the country where you have a lot of freedom. You can do anything and everything, and you are respected. Nobody is here to judge you and stop you. But now I feel that someone is watching me. Wherever I go, I started looking at everybody right now like a suspect. I see everyone, and I'm like, oh my God, there is someone who's staring at me. And I get worried, and I move on. If I'm driving, I just drive fast, get home, and then we feel that home is a safe space for us and hope that this changes soon because I came here with a lot of dreams to settle down here. And if I want to settle down, I want to definitely make sure that me and my future generations are ensured safe.
Tell me about the town you come from. It seems like a lot of the young people there, it seems anyway, study tech stuff. Like it's kind of a Silicon Valley type training ground for innovative tech careers. And a lot of people seem to go abroad for jobs and education, especially young people.
Yes. I come from Hyderabad, and it's the world's second largest and best city when compared to a few statistics. And I carry a lot of pride when I say that I belong to Hyderabad.
Wait, what do you mean best?
We have like the best international schools, let it be the opportunities we are given by the government or the younger generations, the housing and a lot more opportunities. And why I love saying that is because in Hyderabad, what we have is freedom. And a lot of students who come from Hyderabad have this common thing which goes on in the families like MS in US. No matter what we do, we give importance to education a lot. And for us, education doesn't stop after our basic education. And every parent encourages us to go and pursue higher education, especially in the United States. Because for us, U.S. is the one, the land of dreams. And that is the reason lots and lots of people come here with those hopes.
Tell me more about your upbringing.
I'm a single parent child, and my mom has given us a lot of freedom. My sister right now resides in New York. She's working as a project manager, and I was given always the freedom and the benefits of being the little one, because whenever my mom says, no, you can't do it, my sister is the one who encourages, and vice versa. And I had the chance to do anything and everything, let it be pursuing dance as my serious thing, or let it be doing my education, working, hanging out with my friends in lines and all, anything. I was given the freedom. And even when I was coming here, my mom was only scared about one thing, that me being vocal about everything. She was like, it's okay, at times you can let it go. People may not agree with you, but it's okay. It may not be the right thing, but it's the right thing to let it go, because you have to respect other people's view too.
Tell me more about your decision to come and study at UMKC.
I chose UMKC because of two main reasons. One was the scholarship and the place it was located, because when we come here, we consider climate as one of the major reasons too. So I was like, okay, this is not too snowy, and also, though we have the typical Kansas City weather, I was like, okay, this can be my place. And the second one was the tagline, which is UMKC, the place for people going places. And that attracted me really well. I was like, wow, I'm a wanderlust and I love traveling. I was like, okay, this sounds something different, and let me try this. Maybe this will be my place. But as far as I'm concerned with UMKC, I have the root spirit, and I carry it along wherever I go, and it has given me wonderful opportunities, be it in my academics, co-curriculars, or extracurriculars, and I love it. And whenever there was any crisis, leadership team has always worked the best to come up with ideas and how to address it, not just verbally, but also through their actions.
What about this crisis? I mean, the response to the shooting, how have you felt about the school's response to that? One of the student who was injured went to UMKC.
Personally, my advisor, I'm also the student body president, and my advisor is Tiffany Hamilton. She reached out to me on my cell phone. She was texting and she asked me how I was doing. And also then she asked me, like, me and the leadership team, let us Chancellor's leadership team, want to know from you in person, how would you like us to react on this situation? And we are having a gathering today in UMKC Quad from 1:30 to 3 p.m. So she said, okay, the leadership will be there. And they are trying to come to us and talk to us, not just advise us about the do's and don'ts, because we can't control what happens around the world, but we can control what happens in our world. So she has always been advising us, and she said that they'll be providing all support, whatever we need. Let it be addressing their family, because all we normal students received was an email and update about saying, okay, we know about this and how we feel about it. But what people don't know, like most of the students, is how they're working with Indian students especially and trying to address the issue, because Alok especially belongs to India and from my city too. And they reached out to me in person and said, okay, if this is what they want to do, okay, we are going to do this.
So they're taking cues from you.
Yes, they are.
Well, that's nice. You know, when you mentioned earlier that this incident, this shooting, it's not how you thought about Kansas or Missouri before you came here. How did you think of Kansas or Missouri? I mean, I don't know how we are perceived in India.
When I said I'm going to choose UMKC, my sister was like, are you sure? Midwest is not having the vibe you want, because I'm a party animal and I like more crowd and I'm used to more crowd. So she asked me, are you going to be okay there? And my initial days were
not. She was afraid you were going to be bored?
Yes. And even now she's asking me every time. She's like, whenever I see your Instagram or Facebook, you're doing a lot of things, but I don't think so. There's so much to do there. I say, yes, there is there. That is the perception even I had initially. But later on, what I saw was, yes, Kansas City, especially Kansas and Missouri, have a different vibe where every race is addressed in a respectful manner, I can say. Let it be the Irish Fest or Renaissance Fest, the Plaza Art Fair, or different sort of fest we have initially. I was like, wow, they do recognize each and every person and they celebrate it in pride. And that is the reason I love it. Initially, I didn't think about Kansas City and Missouri. I thought, okay, it'll be a little laid back, maybe, as everybody says, Midwest is a little laid back. But what I discovered coming here is it's growing, let it be technologically or with the multiple races coming in here, and diversity is really important, which I see a lot here.
You know, I mean, we've heard that the shooting last week has been in headlines in India. It's been a big topic on social media among people in India and from India. And I wonder if you had heard about this before choosing UMKC, if that would have stopped you from considering a place called Kansas City.
Yes, definitely. Because in India, we come from a place where parents take most of our decisions and they play a vital role, let it be in our day-to-day life, like calling us 5 times a day. So if I'm applying for some universities, definitely my parents and my family would be the ones who will be knowing it first. And they would be saying no. Because my sister or most of our families have someone or the other person living in the U.S. So they'll definitely say, no, 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 you're definitely not going. Not just Missouri or Kansas City, but it would be no to U.S. too.
You've mentioned that your dream of settling down in Kansas City might be affected depending on whether you start to feel safer again or not. What would make you feel safer again, and what are some things that for you would be kind of deal breakers?
Maybe the government coming up and joining hands, saying and taking a stand very strictly and saying, okay, this is some action we are going to take for hate crimes and this is not acceptable. Because what happens is when we have few systems which are negligible to one particular or which are not addressing few minorities, then it becomes easy for any people to address them in a negative way and take action like killing.
Let's bring Mansoor Rahman into this discussion. He's here from Bangladesh, and he's a semester away, I understand, from earning his PhD in computing and engineering, also at UMKC. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, thank you.
And congratulations on how far you've come toward your PhD.
Thank you so much.
How long have you been here?
I have been here more than 5 years.
Does Kansas City feel like home to you? I mean, do you feel like this is a place where you fit in?
Perfectly, yes. I feel Kansas City my second home. I went to New York after finishing my master's and started my PhD there in Stony Brook University in Long Island. And I feel something missing there that I got in Kansas City. So I came back to UMKC again to start my program, and I'm continuing my PhD here.
What about this incident has surprised you?
Well, it's definitely surprised me, especially in Missouri and Kansas City area. I know that this kind of things are happening throughout the U.S. many places, but once it happens in Kansas City, especially in Kansas and Missouri area, it shocked me. It shocked me a little bit, and I am so sad for those family who are feeling that they're safe there, but they somehow got injured or they somehow got killed. But at the same time, I'm seeing some really good things. That's the beauty of U.S., that the response of the people, how they are responding those kind of crime. And
is there an example that's really touched you?
Yes, honestly, I see that the people are really not accepting at all in here in U.S. And the law enforcement, everybody is helping to stop this crime. And you will not see maybe these kind of things in all over the world, but I'm so happy to see that how the people are helping the family, how the people are helping those people to get some relief from this pain. And you see the people who were there, even and U.S. people who get hurt to stop that guy to shoot them. So that's really touched me. How
just the fact that someone intervened,
right?
And
yeah,
not only risked injury, but in fact was injured himself.
Right, exactly. So that's really give me some hope that yes, this is the place where there is no place for a hater and there is no opportunity for a hater.
Is Kansas getting a reputation in Bangladesh the way it maybe is in India right now?
I do not exactly know, but I don't think that much. There are some news in media, but I think it's instead of just Kansas, I think it's overall give the idea of U.S.
What about the fact that this gunman who fired shots that killed Srinivas Kuchibhotla and injured Alec Madasani seems to have mistaken them for being Middle Eastern? Is that a significant detail to you?
Yes, I heard that, and it also shocked me a little more. Why, I mean, what wrongs with this Middle Eastern? You have to kill all the Middle Eastern there. And what's wrong with them? I mean, I don't think he was okay. I mean, he just found someone to blame right now, but these kind of people, they will find blame to anyone after a few days. He now thinks the Middle Eastern people are bad. Maybe after a few days, he will say, okay, those people are bad. Then maybe they will feel their friends are bad to them, so they need to kill. So I don't know what's going on in his mind and why he thinks that then he needs to kill the Middle Eastern people.
What about you, Navia?
This behavior is also because of what happened a few years ago in the United States, wherein foreign was treated as suspects, terrorists, where we were judged with based on the color of our skin. Okay, these people are foreign, whereas brown bodies are treated as illegal. And
is there a specific incident from a few years ago that you think started this, or just a general mood?
I would say 9/11, because that one was such a dreadful one which happened and which shook the whole world, which shouldn't have happened. After that, people started naming that, okay, this particular race, this particular religion is responsible for it, but holding one person responsible against the whole incident and what happens later shouldn't be done, because this is 2017. And if you see in any educational institution, especially Middle Easterns and Muslims are doing a lot better than what we know of. They're doing a lot of research. They're bringing laurels not just to the university, but to the country too. And I totally don't feel that this is how it is supposed to go on, blaming just the Middle Eastern or Muslims against anything.
You mentioned the phrase brown bodies. Can you say more about that phrase?
I said that brown bodies are blamed and named illegal because this person, especially when he approached these two Indians, Alok and Srinivas, asked them if they were legal and inquired about their visa status and said, no, these people, because they were brown, he assumed them to be Muslims and from Middle Eastern and said they are illegal. And then he got returned from his place with a gun and shot at them. One thing which runs in everybody's mind was, if he was white, maybe he would have escaped it. And if his color of the skin was a little lighter, maybe he would have escaped it. If he was, in his appearance, he was looking more American, maybe he would have got saved and he wouldn't have to face this thing.
We're going to pick right back up with this conversation after the break. If you want to share your thoughts about the conversation that's emerged about last week's shooting in Olathe and how people are reacting to it, both locally and globally, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. We've been talking to UMKC students from India and Bangladesh about their response to the shooting that targeted two young Indian men, both Garmin employees, at a bar in Olathe last week. Now let's hear from Venkat Manda. He hosts a radio show on KKFI that features Indian music and members of Kansas City's Indian community. Venkat, what are members of that community who you've interacted with in the last week, what are people saying to you about this shooting? Is the conversation in your circles different in some way from the one you're hearing in the mainstream media?
I think it is somewhat different for sure. I mean, I probably had to start with saying that, yes, I have it has been a very unfortunate incident. And I have interacted with quite a few members of the community. And when I say community, I do not say Indian community. I talk about the Indians and the general American public. And I used to live in Olathe, and I went to the first vigil at the First Baptist Church also. So I interacted with a lot of folks in the community. There was a lot of interaction. I think that's that's the first part of the question that you asked. In terms of the actual, you know, okay, what is the I think the word is hate mongering, and I don't think So I probably differ from a lot of folks here because, so yes, this person did say, hey, I think he was, I'm trying to target Middle Easterns, I think that's what he said to that bar attendant where he was finally arrested.
Yeah, he went to Applebee's and shared that. That's what he thought he had done, yeah.
Right. And that basically gives a tone of, oh, okay, so was he looking for Middle Easterners? And then saying, okay, if you... So that's one aspect of it. Yes, that definitely brings up the question. But at the same time, you got to look at the facts of the case also. The guy was drunk, senseless. People who are drunk have definitely, proven not to make sound decisions. They don't think properly. So but at the same time, this guy got into a fight. He was drunk, obviously, but he got into a fight or some sort of an altercation or some sort of a discussion with these, with our folks here. And then Ian came up and see, every time I think one thing I want you to, suggest to you folks is every time you mention Srinivas and every time you mention Alok, please do mention Ian also. Because Ian was one of the, catalysts in this whole thing. I think my whole thing is if he was also a quote-unquote white person, then he would not have come to rescue this. So this is not a color thing in my view, okay? In my view, this was a drunk person who made a decision, and unfortunately, he had access to a gun that did not have the proper safety lock on it, that a drunk person should not be able to operate a weapon of that caliber, and then he was able to come back and do what he did.
So for you, this is about guns?
That's my first thought.
Yeah, it sounds like this is a little bit more about guns than it is about race or ethnicity or national origin.
So, yes. So I think prima facie, that's what it looks to me, right? But I do want to wait for the full investigation results to come out, and that's when I'll probably say, oh yeah, there is a bigger problem. But yes, see, again, the other thing is a drunk person just say no, I'm drunk today, so I'm going to be talking about Middle Easterns today, let me see if I can shoot some Middle East. That's not what also there, right? So obviously there is a sentiment in the country, right, that that is because of the current climate we are in. We could talk about the elections, but I don't want to blame the current climate yet, because I still see hope. I see hope because of the outpouring of support that we had from the community. See, I was one of the organizers of the vigil yesterday. Right. We've worked with the India Association and all the local Indian associations. We organized the vigil. And to be very frank with you, right, during the planning phases of this, during the planning calls that we had, we were expecting about 600 people. Oh, yeah, if we get 600 people, we have done a good impact on the society. But guess what? There were thousands of people there. Right. And if you, I don't know if you saw any aerial shots of the people who joined there. There, I mean, 50 to 60% of that was somebody who is not of the white color. So I don't think it matters what the color of the person who had the gun in his hand, and what the person who was hit. I think it matters first that the person was drunk, and yes, he probably used that as an excuse, and he did what he could. But then, why was he able to do what he did, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say, we're gonna, of course, keep learning more about what did and didn't happen, and as you've said, like, there's gonna be more of an investigation. And I want to hear more from you, but we're getting some calls, and I'd love to bring some other voices in on the conversation. So can you hang with me a little?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Let's hear from Bala. Bala's calling from Overland Park. Welcome to the show. Bala, are you there?
I was on mute. Thank you very much for taking my call. Appreciate it. First of all, I want to thank Ian, the brave soul that actually stepped in selflessly to protect two, you know, minority folks who are at a disadvantage. Really appreciate what he had done. I couldn't imagine anybody, you know, taking a bullet for somebody who he didn't even know, from what I understand. I don't know those all three of them personally, but I think, you know, what he has done is extraordinary. Second, you know, Srinivas' wife, you know, to come out and you know, give that speech, the really brave of her to kind of address the problem. And
right, where she basically demanded and, that government officials do something, like do something now.
Yes. And third, you know, this is, you know, the guy, you know, like, you know, he was drunk. But fundamentally, I think, you know, it's the problem of being ignorant, right? Associating a brown skin to a religion or a faith or from a country, you know, shows total ignorance from his part. Whether he's drunk or not, you know, he took a life for no reason because he assumed something was completely you know, incorrect. This is not a problem just for U.S. It's a global problem. If you think about it, you know, people profile, you know, others by the way they look and do things. And it's all over the globe. And I think, you know, we need to start educating our young, exposing them to other cultures. You know, the news media needs to be able to, you know, not only just talk about the, you know, local problem and you know, the good things that are happening locally, but also be able to expose, you know, folks to other part of the world, other religions, other cultures, and also be able to appreciate the other side. It's not just, you know, us, you know, me, and it's about coexisting in this world.
Bala, can I ask you a question? Because right now, do you think that in the current climate, do you think that there's a way to do that without it being seen as political? Like to just do that from human to human, teach people about how other people live?
I think so. I think there is no question about it. You know, it just needs the right mindset and, you know, and exposure. And it's not one person going to be able to do it. It's everybody need to come together to be able to do that. And it's been proven. It's not like, I mean, India is one of the largest democracy in the world, and we coexist. I mean, we do have, you know, rights here and there every now and then. But if you think about it, I mean, I grew up in, I'm a Hindu. I went to a Christian school run by nuns, and I graduated, and I have Muslim friends, I have Jain, I have Christian friends, and I have been to mosque, I've been to the church, and I've been to, you know, the temple. So for me, I am not, you know, I understand, I follow my religion, but at the same time, I understand and I appreciate other people's religion, right? As long as there is no extreme, you know, views and say, you know, when somebody says, you know, mine is better than yours, you're a loser right there.
Thank you so much for that call, Bala.
Yeah, yeah. And one last thing, you know, the FBI, this definition, you know, if you look at their website, this particular one really fits the bill. And there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, we'll be, I'm sure, hearing a lot more about that. But thank you so much for that call. And now let's talk to Daniel and Lawrence. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm just calling in because a couple of aspects of the story, I think, resonated with me personally. So, when I was younger and an undergraduate, that was around 2001, so around September 11th. And at that time, I'm a brown person, so that's a phrase that the first guest had talked about. And somebody had actually committed an act of violence towards me by confusing me with a Middle Eastern. So that's a very scary thing. But the second thing is, I think this is an issue at large that affects brown people and more largely people of color. And this can include immigrants, such as the guest, and also people who are children of immigrants living in the United States, such as myself. So I just wanted to make the point that, unlike one of the earlier callers, I think this is certainly an issue about race. And it's important, I think, just to point out that it's a larger issue. And so brown people of all sorts have various types of types of problems. And I think this can be a unifying point of view to just realize that this issue is somehow something larger. And in this particular case, it happened to be people from India. But, you know, I think there's something definitely bigger going on. And I think that's mostly the point I wanted to make.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about the bigger thing that's going on? Because it's tricky to talk about this. I mean, it can easily sound, and I don't think anyone sounds like they're saying this, but it could sound like when you talk about the problem of being mistaken for a Middle Easterner, like as though that would somehow make this different. When I think what you're saying, what everyone's saying, is that the fact that people are sort of lumped together is a symptom of a larger problem.
Yeah, sorry. So maybe I wasn't clear. I definitely mean the second one. So I think it's ridiculous. I mean, whether I was mistaken for Middle Eastern or not, I mean, that doesn't justify anything. But my point is that that happened in this case. But in general, this isn't an issue about being a Middle Easterner or an Indian. I think somehow it's an anti-immigrant sentiment that's in the country, and it affects large groups of people. And I view it as that. I mean, this person who was drunk in a bar, I could easily imagine that have been myself or, for example, my father, if somebody happened to be speaking Spanish, say, and there's somebody who's in a bar and they're drunk and they just have this opinion that, you know, go back to your country. That's a pretty broad sentiment that applies to many people. So I think many people, either immigrants or children of immigrants, are kind of feeling the same sort of stress that many people in the community are feeling now.
Thanks, Daniel. And Navia, you were the one who initially brought up that phrase, brown people. Is there anything more you want to say about that?
Yes. India is land which believes in Atithi Devo Bhava, which means guests are the gods, and we treat them with utmost respect. And we go to any place expecting the same thing, because I'm a person who treat others the way I want to be treated. And when we come here as brown bodies, we carry pride being brown. We never feel ashamed for being brown, because there's nothing we need to be ashamed of, because we are what we are, and we are improving the way things are going around. When someone rephrases or just points out to us and says, hey, you're brown, you can be like this, or someone wearing a hijab pointing to them saying, oh, that's a Muslim, maybe they are like this, Islamophobia or anything, it creates not just a fear in other people who are around, but also it creates a sense of a common crowd mentality saying, this crowd is going to do this forever. So this has to change, because as most of our friends said, like Bala said, he has friends from different ethnicities, even I have. And maybe having that educated me more and respecting more religions.
Let's hear very quickly from Kathleen in Overland Park. Kathleen, we've just got a little while left, but we'd love to hear from you.
I just wanted to mention the fact that this bartender in Clinton, Missouri, is America, not the man who committed this horrible, tragic act.
So the man who called the police when...
Yeah, it was a woman, bartender at Applebee's. And, well, that's okay. But the fact that he thought he could tell another person that he killed these people and that it would be acceptable. And it's not acceptable. He thought he was America. He's not America. That bartender is America.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. That's a really beautiful note to end on. Our time is up, but keep talking about all of this, Kansas City. Venkat Mandav with us from KKFI. Thanks for sharing your perspective this morning. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
And Navia Sani, Mansur Rashman, good luck at UMKC.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation as well as our discussion about changes at the pitch at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it all ready for you by the end of the day, and you can continue the discussion on Twitter. We're at kcurcst. Tomorrow, in the latest dispatch from The More Things Change, The More They Stay the Same, propaganda from posters in World War I to memes on the internet. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.